Mr. Robinson, Reel 5. We're talking about your period with the initial training wing at Bridge North in Shropshire. But there's just one thing that you've mentioned that was of interest I want to drop in. This is when you had your injections at Lord's, or, you know, when you were at Viceroy Close. Could you tell us about that on tape, please?
Yes, on the third, about the third day of actually being in the at St John's Wood, and we were all marched out to Lord's Cricket Ground from Viceroy Court, where we were living, and early one morning, we had to be prepared to stand in the queue and watch everybody else having their injections before we had ours, which was a bit disconcerting to some of the people there who collapsed on the spot. And one of the instances I noted, there were others behind me going in and making noises. And I'd never had any injection of any sort in my life, so I had no idea what was to happen, so I just put it on this try, so to speak. And we were marched up, first of all, to a giant, what seemed to me at that time, a giant tank of water, which was a sink with taps running. We asked to put our hands on the edge of it, and two chaps in white coats with four scrubbing brushes anywhere in this garden came along and, I suppose, disinfected our arms, scrubbing like mad with some form of soap and disinfecting. And we were asked to keep our arms out straight and walk forward past a row of four, as I recall, about four doctors or four assistants, each with a different type of table with different types of syringes on. And as you walk past them, they screwed one arm and jabbed it in your arm and said, this is for tetanus, or this is for typhoid, or this is for whatever. And then finally, the ultimate thing was a blood test, where you sat down for that, and they shoved this needle in your arm with a giant, again, it seemed to me a giant syringe, and threw out your blood into this thing, the side of which was a little bit disconcerting. Then you had to, they rubbed it with a, I probably didn't know this, with a piece of cotton wool and that sort of stuff. You had to walk out with your arm in the upright position and stand there for about, holding a plaster type thing on your arm for about 5 minutes, and then they took a look at it and said, okay, you can go now. And because of the trauma of this about an hour's curing and stabbing, you were allowed to have the rest of the day off. There wasn't much of a day left by the time you cured and all that. The rest of that, but not actually off. You were put on to light fatigues, which meant polishing floors and cleaning various things that they decided you should clean. And at about, I think it was about 4 o'clock, something like that, they said, okay, you can now relax.
Did you have any sort of reaction to the injections?
Nothing. Well, I mean, I didn't. I thought there would be, but there was nothing.
Now, back to Bridge North. We've been going through the sort of weapons training and things. That's sort of infantry training. What about, you mentioned you'd never even seen an airplane. What other training did you get during that? You were there about 4 weeks.
We had Morse code. We still carried on with the Morse code training, which took up every morning virtually 3 hours of that. It was quite intensive stuff. To learn a thing like that, it's almost put into your system, so to speak, so that you can do it naturally. And so we did that quite intensively. We had talks about mostly general things, as I recall, what was expected of us later on, what was expected of us when we get to radio school and try and start flying and the rest of it. And there's no actual training, as I recall, specifically designed for one something. It was just purely getting your feet into the Air Force and doing all the things that most airmen were expected to do, so that you could then concentrate later on your technical training, which occupied all your time, as you see later on.
Was their method of teaching Morse code any different from the ATC?
It's a bit more rigid, a bit more disciplined. That's perhaps the wrong word, but a little bit more heavy-handed. You know, there was no no excuse for making a mistake, so to speak. You know, you had to get on and do it right and keep on doing it until you got it right. For instance, in drill, you did lots of drills on the square, marching all sorts of formations and whatnot. And if you did an about turn at the wrong time, about 5 minutes after everybody else, you never heard the end of it. Things like that were really, really made a little bit, what's that word, put a lot of pressure on us to do it right. And at the end, we were, towards the end of the course, we had to do everything right on the square at certain parades, so like SEO's parade, church parade, and all that, which everybody had to attend. That was another thing which was introduced to people, the church parade, which you had to be there, whether you had a persuasion yourself or not. And we were told that if you came up with some obscure Chinese religion that you follow, then they find somewhere for you to go and do it. Well, that mostly finished up in the cookhouse. That was the general thing of it. But most people, the Catholics, the Jewish people, and everything else, they're all somewhere to go. They're all the church for most of the major religions. But the important thing was it was a sales parade, and you had to be there, however well you were or not. And then, of course, on the page, you came across this thing, fall out the sick, and those who wanted to report sick didn't want to pace backward and were marched off to the medical unit to be inspected. 50% of the check out, and they weren't really sick, they were just getting out of the parade. You learn all this sort of stuff, and so you can't do this, and you've got to do it properly. But mostly that sort of thing, indoctrinating you into the Air Force routines, the Air Force ways of life, as it were. So that technical training will come more easily.
Now, you were called cadets, weren't you?
That's right. It was to distinguish us from the permanent ground staff that existed on the campus, the teachers, the drill instructors, and PT people, all this sort of thing. We were told to because we wore this white flash in our cap, and we distinguished us physically, but they couldn't call out airmen all the time, because that could apply to people on the ground, so we had to be called cadets for the purpose of our distinction from the others.
Now, what about in, you know, you'd spend the day training. What about in the evening? What did you do then?
Well, in British North, one could go out in the evening if you wanted to, but very few people decided to do that money because very few could afford to do it. On our 3 shillings a day, we were getting mainly not much fun even getting money as well as well. And so most people went into the Renafi or the I think they're called Toc H, which was the one by the Treasury Engine. And where you could go and indeed get 40 bars of chocolate in the Toc H, which was where you went to first and then went to the Nazi artists where you could play snooker or table tennis or whatever, the cards or whatever you wanted, all the equipment provided. And so most people did that, but they didn't want to go. Occasionally they went into town, but not really at this one. You couldn't afford it. Really.
Now, you were there over Christmas. Did you get homesick at all?
Yes, a little bit. That was an unusual thing. We'd never been away for Christmas from home. And therefore, this came as a little bit of a, not a shock, but a thing I had to do, and that was it, really. And what I kept seeing what was happening at home, and what were they doing there? And I was in this place out in the country somewhere, miles from anywhere, and we had a Christmas lunch, the usual thing where the officers served the other ranks. It was a non-event, I thought, at the time. We had a proper roast meal, and they were all very good. And afterwards, there was nothing to do, absolutely nothing. The whole concert or anything. The other places I went to had some entertainment, there was absolutely nothing. Even the cinema, so I recall, wasn't open on Christmas Day, whereas the cinema on the camp was open every day. And, other places, but to here it wasn't a Christmas.
Now, the end of the course, were you assessed, or were you aware of how you were assessed?
There was a sort of assessment. All the time, throughout the whole of the training, there was assessment taking place weekly, daily, and monthly, and proper exams, and all the rest of it. But here, it was just a general assessment. I think most of the information came from the corporal who was in charge of you as a unit, or as a small group of acts, or he was the one who made the drill, drill instructor and everything else. He moved around from place to place. There was no, as I recall, no real assessment in the classes. I mean, there was nothing really being sort of any other than routines or the Air Force routines. So you've given some assessment. The assessment being just that you can now move on to technical training. If they thought you couldn't, you were quietly disappeared from the camp. You were close to the way and no one ever knew. Or as it was, those charges gone and nobody's not with us. They must have gone somewhere else for training. So this sort of thing happened. It was done quite discreetly. It wasn't a public announcement.
Now, you went to your next posting in January. That'd be January 44. Where was that to?
That was the Yatesbury in Wiltshire, about 12 miles from Swindon. It wasn't a purpose-built RAF station. It wasn't a pre-war one. It was built for the duration. It was a very large camp. There were four aircrew wings, so-called, of which it was said there was something like 800 to 900 people in each of the wings. So it's roughly the sort of about 3,500 people training there. There was also, as I found out, well, I knew at the time, there was a rather secret group of people that we never had contact with, who were actually screened off from the rest of us by barbed wire. Also RAF people, and they're told they're doing training on secret equipment. They should turn it to be radars. We had a week's leave in between going from one camp to the other. It was really our first week's leave. We had a 48-hour pass in between Bush and Norfolk, just a little moment by the time I got home in the back, it was about 24 hours really. We got to Yates, we were met at the station and replaced it, and I've never been on that path as well. And taken by truck up to the camp with all our kit, and expected to see quite a different arrangement to the original camp. We weren't disappointed because it was with the size of the camp, it was quite enormous. And to one side of it was a small airfield, just a fast covered airfield, which was made by the aircraft for the first time. We saw airplanes. Now, are these ours or are they belonging to somebody else? We thought somebody told that it used to be occupied by the Bristol Airplane Company, which was just down the road. Bristol wasn't all that far away. And indeed, there were parts of aircraft belonging to them, stowed away, hidden away in bushes at the altitude of record aircraft. And they were then spent a whole day virtually getting us into various huts and sorting ourselves out there, and finding where the cookhouse was, finding where the matthew was, finding where everything, our way about the camp, which I say was so large at first, it was a bit formidable. But
now, what wing were you put into? There were four wings. Do you know what number or what squadron you were within?
Yes, I can. Yes, I was put in number one aircrew wing, X-35 unit. The X-35 is the number of the huts, actually, of which there were about 25 people in the hut, a bit more space than we had at originally. And it was for just a nominal C squadron, it was called, Class D. So if you imagine a very large camp like that, we had to be divided down into those categories. I remember which one they were in, although in practice it had been one of the sooner. And it was, as I say, we spent the whole day virtually just finding our way, but we were able to do that and find out what was wrong with it and what might be the disadvantage. The camp was actually on the main London Road, which is now the A41. And in one direction, about half a mile away, was Beckhampton Corner, famous horse racing, horse training place. And so therefore every day you saw horses, big on horseback, exercising them. In the other direction was the little town of Calne, that's C-A-L-N-E, which was noted for the Harry Spaken factory that used to exist in those days. They were based there, that was all that was based there, Calne, that's where that whole industry was down. So we thought naturally that Bacon would be on our menu quite frequently, but of course it didn't quite work out that way. And Swindon, I say, was about 10 miles away, so that was some way to go to. We spent the whole day just working all this out. At the same time, we suddenly saw aircraft taking off and flying around the lane again. So I thought, well, this must be something. No one had told us at this stage what they were. And then next day, we actually came up very early and played and then marched to have talks by various and by the commanders and all those bits, and guess what went on there and what their training would be. And then we were given a program for the next 3 months. The course ran for 6 months, and we were going to, I think, 3 months of time we were given to see what was going to take place. And as I recall, we did work for 8 days and then had one day off. So every day off was a different day of the week, which was quite a good idea, really. It was quite a bit fatiguing to do 8 days non-stop. But however, we got over that one. The group of chaps I was with were very mixed up of all religions, of all political persuasion, of all kinds. It was quite a little bit different. So we all felt we'd got somewhere by getting as far as all the technical training. We made some progress, and therefore the enthusiasm was a little bit greater. And also, when we got to the classroom stage, we found people rather keen, because we actually felt we were contributing now towards getting our qualification.
Now, what form did the training take then? I mean, this was your wireless operator training, operator gunner training at the time.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. So therefore, it was very comprehensive. We had lectures on, actually, inevitable Morse code, of course, which was the use of Morse code visually by all the cinema, and fire flags as well, and they're not Morse code, but all kinds of signaling was part of the training, but mostly Morse code, of course. And they had lectures on procedures of operating in communication with aircraft. This was in the early days. We just had how to contact another aircraft contact base, this sort of thing. Later on, the navigation part came into the scene of things. But at that time, we were wireless operated air gunners, so therefore we had to do a little gunnery training.
That's true. Before we go on to the gunnery, the Morse code, what speed were you getting up to at this stage?
I personally was about 18 years in
the. So you'd gone up about 6.
The minimum requirement. So we were told that 18 was a pass, 20 was something to address, and 22 was the aim we should go for in the event. It came naturally, so you could get to 25,000, but it's purely an academic thing, because in an aircraft you can't possibly send at that speed when your aircraft's going around all over the place and no one else can receive it probably while sending it that fast. So it was purely an academic aim to get you to be able to read it without thinking about it, which is like another foreign language, and it became nice. So it came a bit like that, really.
Some people say it's like music, you know.
Yeah, that's right. It's very similar in a way. Some of the musicians learn it very, very quickly. It's a type of a thing where you're timing things out to it. Like dots and dashes, it will time out a dash with 3 times a ring for a dot, for instance. This sort of thing is the theory of it. And the instructor we had was probably the best instructor of anything I've ever met. And that man was a chap called Johnny Hoskins, who was a civilian, very heavily built chap, Australian, who was a chap who introduced speedway racing to this country before the war. And he therefore said, you know, if you go to Wembley or Hackney or places like this, or any chance to speedway, just mention my name, you know me, you can go into nothing, this sort of thing. And he had a tremendous sense of humour. And also, he had two Morse keys, one we all have, which means we're moving up and down. We also had an American automatic key, whereby you press one side and it sent dots. You press it the other way, it sent dashes automatically. And so we just moved it back and forth like that, and the clarity of it, or the perfection of it, was unbelievable. It's like a machine sending it out. And he did it that way so well that you had no difficulty in reading. But other people are a little bit erratic, and most people are erratic in seeing all the reading and seeing this. It's not quite as straightforward as it ought to be for various reasons. And sending in particular is one of the hardest things to send into the sea. And he is a great person, and therefore I think we all have speed up quite rapidly. It's hard to get past 18 words a minute. It's pretty difficult. It's a lot of blockage there. People get to that point, or not quite that point, and just can't get past it. It's like all these things of that nature where there's a stepping stone you've got to get past. And he did it all of us without any problem at all.
What methods did he use? I mean, why was he such a good instructor?
I don't know. I never knew his background and how he got into this, because it's completely different to anything he'd ever done before. By the sound, maybe he was involved in the school.
But how did he sort of get you past? Why was he so good?
I think it's good because of the way he sends it. The way he transmitted it to us was so like a machine. If you heard it on a machine, a tape, for instance. The gaps and the pauses and dashes and the dots, the sequence were so clearly defined, which you can't do back from one by hand. Not by anything else that achieves that sort of clarity.
Did this machine to automatically send out?
Yes, the American key.
Did they use them in the RAF?
No, I don't actually. Not in the air, of course. But
why not? I mean, it sounds a good idea to me.
Well, yeah, because in practice, in the air, you're lucky if you can do about 10 words a minute. In those type of aircraft, I don't know, it's a base aircraft. Of course, in those type of aircraft, you're falling around all over the place. It's going down here and up here.
So it didn't matter? You could do
matter,
the...
No, I think you had to do the speed. Clearly, as a, I think because if you didn't make it as aircrew, you could be put onto the ground training. Where between the ground stations, they would do 18 words a minute. They've got nothing to do.
Was there much? I mean, that's Morse. I mean, what about the talking side, the telephone?
That was only the pilot did that in an aircraft. There's no reason for any of the other crew to talk to the ground. Because as a wireless operator, I was in charge of the transmitter that the pilot used, which is a different transmitter than I had, and it's purely for voice and not for Morse, because we're sending Morse code on a different type of system to speech, and the speech one range is much less than the Morse code. Morse code can go for about, in those days, about 300 miles, which was long enough to far enough to take bearings and all this sort of from a long distance station of some sort, or beacon or whatever. And as far as the pilot's going, he only wanted it for taking off and landing virtually.
What was the range of the voice one then?
About 50 miles, I would think, not much more. He never really needed it, because up to about 1900, until the 1000 bomber raids, it was radio silence. That's why the wireless operator was an air gunner, because it wasn't using his radio, because he couldn't use it to give away the position.
And that was a Morse silence as well?
That's right, oh yeah, absolutely. Complete silence. And then from 1940, whenever it was, the early 43, I think there were 1,000 bomber raids, they decided, well, not much point, you've got 50 aircraft in there, or 1,000 things in the sky, and they can see them, there's not much point in having radio silence. So that's when they changed it from wireless operator to air gunner to a signaler, and cut out the gunnery bit.
We'll come on to that, I'm sure. Now, what about, just generally, you had lectures on wireless procedure. I mean,
there was a definite way of calling up a station and getting their attention. Then all the call signs, of course, aircraft was getting the call signs, take off. That was changed every day. On the training at Yatesbury, because of the type of training we were doing, which was fairly elementary, there was no need to use code at all. Our command had their own code, with special books and all that for. But here, it was straightforward plain language, or figures for practice sort of thing, or code for just practice. But mostly it was plain language, and therefore you didn't need code books. We didn't at first do any training with beacons and this sort of stuff. All that part was left so much later on. This was very elementary communication. represent.
So how did you get the attention of the station? Or?
Well, they transmitted and the receiver, both of which are compatible. One can tune to the other. You can tune a transmitter back to a radio, so they're on the same frequency as the one you picked up on the radio. So it's trying to pick up the station. And of course, you're hearing just a lot of people all trying to get through and do their bit of the exercise you were given to do. You had to do so, you know, as many exercises you could with whatever stations you can give up, or again, a list of stations in the area. This is here, later on, it altered that. But you're given the stations, and you had to try to get as many you could on your log that you were keeping of what you were doing.
So you tune in to
the station by the radio, and you hear they're transmitting a call sign all the time. You know, when they're communicating with other people, and you knew what the call sign was, you hear that, so you know you're tuned in that station.
So if you then sent on that frequency, they'd hear you?
Well, providing they're not hearing all the others at the same time. You see, so it's a bit of a jumble going on. And at first, we all found it rather difficult. You've got to be, the time is going to be right, or you've got to be near enough. Or in a right position of wind to hear you, which wasn't always the case, of course. And I found out a little while later on that the trick of the whole thing was to wait till the body stopped. What you have to do is call them up, then call their call sign. Then, and once they heard and said who you were, call sign so and so from so and so, you kept sending that until they heard that, then they will contact you. And I found when they didn't hear you, all they picked up was the loudest one. Or the nearest one, or one that was set, that they would hear out of the jungle. They said, well, I'll hear that one, so I'll answer that one. So I waited till everybody would look at, and then said, just my call sign, not theirs, just mine. And they thought that was the end of it, and then they sent in the initial contact. So they replied to it. I found out that later on, that was a trick you could do to attract their attention away from all the others. I thought, well, wrong really, but you've got an exercise to do, you had to do it. So that was just that, but you couldn't do that but here at the HP. That's it. And we found that we didn't realise all that, but that with all these other people at the same time, you know, there might be 30 aircraft in the air, or quite a lot of aircraft there. And of course, the aircraft we were in to start with were Rapids.
I'll come back to that. I'm really sure. Sticking to the procedure. Oh, so, right. What would you do when you got through? What was the procedure that you adopted, you got through.
Right, the exercise was to call them up and ask them something, which was a theoretical question. What is my position in a straight line? This in fact wasn't in a Q code. What is my position to reach you? And they give you some made up figures, and you've got them, and you thank them for it, and sign off. It was simple things like that. But of course, the difficulty, this is all absolutely, the figure they gave you were, in my opinion, was me. This is a question of making contact. That was the hard part to get the attention of the ground station. And the idea was you have to go, as I said, you have to go as many as you can out of those that existed not too far away from the area.
And was there an etiquette about the order you sent a message in?
Well, that's right, there was. There was a set procedure, a call sign with a letter B in between, which meant from, and then your call sign. And then we use Q codes, which is a standard international code.
What? Could you explain that?
Like Q the M, for instance, meaning what is my magnetic course to you? In other words, you're asking for a bearing. But we're on a straight line magnetically. What would they do? They'd come back with the answer once, Q the N, as it was. 170, 170 degrees to reach me. But we never went in that direction. We just used as a navigational bearing. But we did it with Oakesville just as an exercise of making contact. So we learned all these various procedures and things that we mustn't do. And,